Hello, everybody out there in podcast land, and welcome to the Front Row Flashbacks, a part of the Front Row Network and NPR Illinois Community Voices. I am Ryan Lutens, diehard horror fanboy and all-around Academy Awards snob.
I'm Jay Hoffman, master of the dad joke and interpretive dance.
And I'm Erin McCabe, the peace bringer and insightful mama hen of the show.
Here on Flashbacks, we like to get all nostalgia-like about the movies of our past. Movies from the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s that have shaped the way we look at cinema and pop culture today, and how those movies have given us insight and hope in our everyday lives.
So strap on your fanny packs,
hold on to your butts,
and let's get ready to flashback.
If you have ever been in financial straits and thought, I should pay a googly-eyed man and a Russian to kidnap my wife for an elaborate ransom scheme just to get my money situation fixed, then you may be thinking about Fargo. Welcome to another episode of the Front Row Network's Flashbacks. We have a great episode lined up for you tonight. We've got two guest hosts we're going to introduce to you right now. We've got our own classics host, Brandon Davis. How you doing tonight?
Oh, doing fine, you betcha.
You betcha.
Yeah.
And the reason why he called me You Betcha is because we have another Ryan with us this evening. I've known Ryan probably a greater half of 20 years, maybe probably a little bit longer. Went to school with them. And there's a reason why we asked him onto the show. But before we get into that, Ryan, how's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for having me. Can't wait to talk about this gem of a movie.
It's a great one. And as per our traditions here at the Front Row Network, this is your first show, so we have to ask, what is your favorite movie and why?
Oh, man, it's always the hardest question to answer because you just want to talk about that for 2 hours and not what we're here for. So I think if you had to triangulate my movie lore, just so you all know, it's somewhere between Coen Brothers, Charlie Kaufman, Tarantino, maybe a little bit of Danny Boyle. I think Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is my favorite contemporary film. If we're going way back, I'd say Rear Window. Just love the Hitchcock stuff, and that one's
You're a man of Brandon's heart.
Yes. You have pleased both sides of the aisle here. That's awesome.
Yes. Wonderful.
I love Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, one of my faves.
Mm-hmm.
So Ryan has, I've known Ryan for quite some time, and in when his first year of college at Drake University, he wrote a paper that linked, that talked in detail about Fargo. So that's why we invited him on. I can't wait to hear your thoughts, Ryan. But before we dive in, we have to do our story rundown. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, and for our listeners out there, you know, we got our host, Ryan, who we love, and then our guest, Ryan. And our guest, Ryan, is he's what our host, Ryan, would be if he made good life choices, this, just on physical appearance purely. I just try to give a visual representation for our listeners.
So for the sake of this movie, not to confuse anybody, Steve Buscemi is called the funny-looking guy. So in order to not confuse anybody, I'm the funny-looking guy tonight.
We all are. Thank God this is a podcast. All right, let's get this rundown. A loser of a car salesman has a brilliantly stupid idea to get his financial failures corrected. It's as simple as hiring Steve Buscemi and that dude that plays a Russian in every movie he's in to kidnap his wife, hold her for ransom, and have his rich father-in-law pay the ransom that he will then split with the aforementioned shady dudes. What could possibly go wrong? Murder and mayhem ensue until a perky, pregnant, and incredibly competent police chief are on the case. This is a true story.
Is it, though?
It's not. It's not. No. I love that it starts that.
There's so much speculation behind that when I was reading about this movie. I'm like, jeez. All right.
There are.
Fun facts. Fun facts. Let's get into it.
Fun facts. There are elements of this movie that are not necessarily true, but are that are taken from. And we can get into that later when we talk about it. But Fargo was written and directed by Joel Coen and Ethan Coen. Cinematography by Roger Deakins. I know. Ryan, you've turned me on to the world of Roger Deakins, and I'm here for it. Starring Frances McDormand as Margie Gunderson, John Carroll Lynch as Norm Gunderson, William H. Macy as Jerry Lundegaard, Steve Buscemi as Carl Showalter, Peter Stormare as Geir Grimsrud. Grimsrud?
Grimsrud.
Grimsrud. Russian dude.
Russian dude. Harvey Prisnell as Wade Gustafson. This film had a budget estimated about $7 million, and it grossed domestically $24.6 million. Cumulatively worldwide, it grossed about $60.6 million. It's got a Rotten Tomatoes critic score of 94% and a Rotten Tomatoes audience score of 93%, which I feel like films like that are hard to come across these days.
Yeah, we're always debating the audience versus the critic. And this one's pretty well in check.
These ones are right in line with each other.
Yeah. This movie has been nominated for countless awards. Seven nominations for Academy Awards. You're going to find out in a few months if you didn't know already. Ryan Luton's the funny looking one, is... He's our awards guy, so he's gonna be all into it. This movie scored two wins for Best Original Screenplay for the Coen brothers and Best Actress for Frances McDormand. It Independent Spirit Awards had six nominations and six wins. It got nominated for three Saturn Awards and one win for Best Action or Adventure Film. It's AFI's 100 Years Top 100 Movies, it's number 84. It did not make the 2007 updated list. I'm kind of bummed about that.
Stupid.
For AFI's 100 Years, 100 Laughs, it's number 93.
Such a dark movie. Solid ball.
I mean.
Yeah, but how disturbed. Have you ever laughed harder at a human being shoved into a wood chipper than you did in this movie?
Oh, Jerry, there was no laughing for me.
Even my wife thought that scene was funny, and she does not like that stuff.
When I was texting you guys going, oh, my God, it got even worse. What happened?
He's taking a block of wood, jumping, and can't get him in.
Oh, my God, I know. He looked like my 4-year-old or my 3-year-old trying to shove a block, like, with another block into
why won't
a place that doesn't belong.
Why won't the square fit in the circle?
Seriously.
I think that scene has forever changed the perception of the landscaping industry, because whenever I'm walking down the street and see one of those things out on the lawn,
take like three steps.
Right?
Blood splay. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Whenever I hear a wood chipper, I just see Frances McDormand pointing at her hat.
Police. AFI's 100 Years, 100 Heroes and Villains. Margie Gunderson is number 33 for hero.
Love
Joel
that.
Coen. What?
I said I love that.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, she's awesome. Joel Coen had Frances McDormand and John Carroll Lynch conceive a backstory for their characters to get the feel of them. They decided that Norm and Marge met while working on the police force, and when they were married, they had to choose which one had to quit. Since Marge was a better officer, Norm quit and took up painting. The role of Carl Showalter was written specifically for Steve Buscemi. And William H. Macy begged the directors for the role of Jerry Lundegaard. He did two readings for the part and became convinced he was the best man for the role. When the Coens didn't get back to him, he flew to New York where they were starting production and said, I'm very, very worried that you're going to screw up this movie by giving this role to somebody else. It's my role and I'll shoot your dogs if you don't give it to me. He was joking, of course. The movie is called Fargo because the Coens thought it was a better title than Brainerd.
Yeah, Brainerd. All it's got is a Paul Bunyan.
I know. It's kind of funny because I did think that when I was like, this movie literally does, like, it's got very, very little to do with Fargo. And I did think that, but it's true. It sounds better.
I think it works, though, like, because if you just, like, think that part of the country, you know, there's not a lot of cities that you could
right.
name.
Right.
And Fargo, I think, and maybe it's, too, that this movie played a role in that now.
It became
part of the conscious so much in the 90s. I mean, I remember when this movie, you know, we were all, you know, pretty young when this came out, and it was, you know, I remember it being talked about a lot.
Let's dive into that. Let's talk about our first memories of when we watched Fargo. So Ryan, I want you to think we're gonna do it with Brandon first, and then Ryan will hit you up. Okay. So Brandon, what are your first memories when it comes to the film Fargo?
Well, I don't think I watched the actual movie until, because I wouldn't have been allowed to see it when it came out, because I was like 9 when it came out, so I wouldn't have been allowed to see it.
Aaron was starting your freshman year of college.
So
I was getting my PhD. No.
But I finally saw it in high school, but I was a movie fan when I was a kid, and so I remember, you know, watching like Siskel and Ebert and hearing them go nuts over it. And then I also remember when the American Film Institute list came out and everyone made such a big deal that a movie that was only 2 years old made the list. So I think Fargo was kind of the first mainstream indie movie, kind of. I think it was the first time that something so made on such a small shoestring budget, you know, sort of entered the zeitgeist, the popular zeitgeist, and became mainstream. I mean, and we can talk about it later, but the 96 Oscars are kind of notorious that it was the first year where I think Jerry Maguire was the only movie made by a major studio to be nominated for anything that year. So it's kind of a unicorn in that way, that it's that movie. But I think it's, you don't get too many black comedies that really work, and I think this one works great because it's funny, it's violent, it's touching in a way, and you feel for all of these characters, you know, in different ways, because every single character in this movie is in over their heads in some way, and fate somehow allows all this stuff to happen, and they all somehow manage to, you know, circle through it. But yeah, I think it's a brilliant movie, and I love when something original comes out that's not based on any, you know, other material. It proves that great minds are out there that can think of something that can, you know, capture the imaginations that doesn't come from other source material.
Yep, and that's why it won best original screenplay for the 96 Oscars. Mr. Hunt, tell us about your first memories when it comes to Fargo.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the first memory I have of it relates to why I think the movie is so grand and great to begin with. It's that opening shot. We mentioned the legend Deakins, right? And Brandon mentioned that this movie was made on a shoestring budget, $7 million. It feels a lot bigger than a $7 million movie, right?
It does.
I mean, that obviously goes a lot farther way back then, but still, that's a pretty small budget for a movie that feels so well produced. A lot of that has to do with just the limitless horizons of a blank white canvas of northern Minnesota and North Dakota. But that cinematography is just indelible for me and what always keeps me going back to this movie. But on a more personal note, it's one of the first good movies, I think, that taught me that you can watch film as literature. And that's why I'll always have a strong personal connection and keep on going back to these themes that the Coen brothers are so good at bringing out through their entire filmography. And of course, there's the arresting performances from Frances McDormand and Mr. Bill Macy were just incredible. And I can't wait to dive more into that with you guys tonight.
Absolutely. Aaron, we're going to wait on you because you're unique. Jay, fella.
I don't know. I'm now intrigued by what that even means.
She saw it 3 days ago for the first time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's,
I was going to say, if it was because I was the only one who didn't have a mustache, like, I'm Italian, so that's not actually true.
She turns, that's why the light's so bright.
That's exactly right.
First speakings when you need them.
I don't know when I first saw this movie. I don't know. It's one of those movies I feel intimately familiar with, but I can't place when I first saw it. And I don't know. Ryan, sounds like you got had a very introspective view of it the first time you viewed it. I don't know that I had that. I think the humor worked for me. But I think, when I was younger watching this, I think most of those themes meant very little to me. And I'm going to talk this whole podcast about how important the themes they have in the movie are to me in movies that I watch. And I think it's just one of those things is when you get older and you get responsibility and things. But I always liked this movie, but I like it so much more now. And it's just what Ryan said. You know, I like how you said that. Movie is literature, right? Movies as an art that can give you deeper and more introspective thoughts about life and things of that nature. And this movie has it in spades. And I feel like there's a lot of iconic lines, iconic shots, and just like you said, just the white openness of it, you know, with all the snow, and it almost gives it too. Kind of a neo-Western feel to it, you know. It's not the Wild West where it's, you know, tumbleweeds and stuff like that, but it gives it kind of a Western vibe as well. So I don't know when I first saw it, but I like it more now than I did then.
Yeah. Thanks, big fella. So for me, when it comes to Fargo, I don't remember when I first was introduced. I have grown to love the Coen brothers. I think they present a very unique style of writing and directing, especially about the human character. They always write strong human characters. It's probably their best trait when it comes to writing and directing. But, man, can they put together a movie? But I do remember this. And Jay, this is not on TNT. AMC. Okay, so my father, not a big movie guy, but he'll watch something if it piques his interest. And I remember walking in, and I walked in, it was right around the kidnapping scene. So I'm like, all right, if my dad's watching this, he's interested. And so this is AMC, so a lot of the stuff was edited out, but I was like, man, this is actually a good movie. Like, you know, and this is me, 12 years old, not really, you know, it's just a crime movie to me. When I revisited that in high school, and I'm starting to learn more about the film industry, you know, I'm like, okay, this is very well done. I'm getting the ins and outs. And then when I get to college, I've developed my aesthetic, and I pay more attention to production and cinematography. You know, if you've listened to our show or you've listened to me on a podcast that has Roger Deakins, he is the greatest cinematographer ever. You know, the fact that it took him all his career up until 1917 to get an Oscar is truly, or not, I'm sorry, Blade Runner is truly a crime against, because one of my favorite scenes in this movie is right after Greer ran down the people that witnessed the murder of the cop on the side of the road in pure darkness. All you see is the headlights, and then his shadow emerges, and he's just there, and there's a victim running away. I mean, that image is just so powerful, and it's just the fact that he could create that in pure darkness with just a spotlight was fantastic. But I love the Coen brothers. This is probably one of my favorites of theirs, right after No Country for Old Men. But just I remember watching this with my dad on AMC, and the fact that he actually sat through it. And I don't know if he sat through it because I was there, but or if he liked it. But to me, that meant a whole lot more. So, yeah, that was my first memory of Fargo. You know, that was 22 years ago. Now we're going to come to someone who saw it 3 days ago. Aaron, we forgot to give you a disclaimer when watching this movie. You know, you like those disclaimers. But tell us about your thoughts when you dove into this movie 4 days ago.
It was good. You guys, it was okay, though, because I feel like sometimes, so for anyone who hasn't listen to me on some of the podcasts, like, I'm pretty sensitive. I don't do well with violence. Certain types of, I'm okay with, like, kitschy, like, B-movie violence or, like, gore, but I have a hard time. But this isn't, like, it's not that violent or that crazy. It just all of a sudden everything escalates so quickly. And then I was like, oh, God, everything's bad now.
The text from it were fantastic. This is spiraling out of control.
Like, God, everything got really out of control really fast. And then all of a sudden, like 3 minutes later, I'm like, oh, God, it got worse. Oh, you haven't seen it before. So I can tell you guys when this movie came out in 1996, also Brandon, as far as the best independent film coming out in 1996, I think Trainspotting might want a word with you.
I didn't say best.
No,
I said first mainstream.
First mainstream. You're right. Yes. But so in 1996, like when you look at that roll up, like I didn't see it. I was 14 years old. I can tell you exactly what I was doing in 1996, and that was Romeo and Juliet, Independence Day, The Rock, The Craft. Like, that's what I was into. But I do remember, there's like a weird period of time where, and I know it's not the same year, but Fargo stayed in the zeitgeist exactly. Like, I remember it being talked about a lot. And it was like, oh, my God, this movie. But then there's this weird period of time for me, like somewhere between 1996 and 1998, because I was more into movies than a lot of my other friends would be. You know, like my friends would want to be like, let's go rent Boogie Nights just to see the penis. And I'd be like, guys, but I actually want to watch this movie. Like, can you guys like stop fast forwarding it? Because I need to know what's going on.
Okay, I want to watch the movie, guys.
Yeah, I'm like, no, there's some like really cool things going on in here. Like, forget about the penis. And so anyway, I was like into movies, and I remember there was like this weird period where I felt like The Full Monty and Fargo were like crossing over. Like, people were like talking about those movies constantly. So I think for a long period of time, I actually kind of got those two mixed up, and never saw them, and then. They're totally not the same thing.
No.
they're not anywhere close. But I was like, some people in Minnesota were stripping and taking their clothes off. Like, I don't know. That's not the movie I saw 3 days ago.
Yeah, that's not the location you want to be a male stripper.
They haven't turned Fargo into a Broadway musical yet. So.
And then I think there was kind of a whole thing for me too, where like, it's a Coen Brothers movie. And then there like came a point in time where people, it was like so cool to see a Coen's brother movie where it was like, it's a Coen's brother film. And I'm like, man, get out of here with your mainstream trendy shit. You know, so I was like then being defiant about it.
Were they ever, other than like this movie blowing up though, were they ever like,
I think like this, and then The Big Lebowski, and then No Country for Old Men.
I think that was a bust. I think Big Lebowski was a bust, wasn't it?
Yeah, Big Lebowski had more of a cult, and then Miller's Crossing.
It had a cult following.
Miller's Crossing and Barton Fink were like their two independent films where they got a crap ton of followership, but this was the one where they branched out.
But then, like, Brother, Where Art Thou came out, and, like, it was, like, across the banner, like, Coen's brother film. And, like, people were like, yeah, come on, Coen's brother film. I'm like, get out of here. I'm not, just leave me alone. And like, Hail Caesar and stuff, and, like, I don't know. It was kind of like, I feel that way about certain actors or certain directors for a while. Like, it was kind of like Wes Anderson, too. Like, for a while, it's like, it's a Wes Anderson film. Like, you have to see it in order to be.
Agreed.
Cool.
Erudite. You know what I mean? And I'm like, nah. I'm going back to Cool World and The Rock. Like,
oh, God. I got Michael Bay shit to watch, guys.
You guys see my copy of Dick Tracy?
Exactly. So I watched it 3 nights ago. I loved it. It's one of those movies that I think there's a ton in it upon further viewing. So, like, I actually went back and watched it again, and I just really, really enjoyed it. I think there's, like, a really cool simplicity about it, but it still, but it says so much. There's, and I love a movie that, I don't want to hear anyone's mouth when I say this. I do love a movie that doesn't have to say a whole lot, but says a whole, but says a lot without saying everything. That's what I appreciate in a movie, and I felt like this really did that. And the reason I'm laughing is because I also love Tenet, and that movie says a whole lot constantly. So yeah, that's my feelings. I'm done.
All right. Well, thank you for those thoughts. Let's just talk about the movie, and let's talk about our takeaways. You know, we could talk about themes, cinematography. I mean, there's a lot to talk about and unpack with this movie. So where should we start? Should we just talk about acting? Let's just talk about these roles. Do you want to talk about all the things in between? Jay, you start us off.
Yeah. Acting, I think everybody was very good. What I think, I do think in retrospect now, I think they went a little heavy with the accent. I think they could have subdued it.
Ah.
But that being said, I do think the Coen brothers used the location and that accent to great effect for storytelling. I think they used it to, one, it's that accent, you know, it's that northern states Canadian accent is kind of associated with niceness, courtesy, manners,
yeah.
You know, and then to throw like just bad people in there with you know, with this accent, not all of them had it, but just to throw some rough people in with that accent kind of throws you off a little bit. I think the other thing that it does is I think, especially with Margie, right, with Frances McDormand, she's pregnant the whole movie, and she has this accent, and her husband's the whole time, oh, hey, Margie, I brought you lunch, Margie. I made you breakfast, Margie. You know, like the whole time, it's just like this really sweet but, like, simple, right? It gives us, I think, a viewpoint where I was like, oh, these are just, like, dumb, simple folk. And it's not true, right? So I think it's a thing that it lures you into thinking that Margie is somebody you don't have to worry about, that you don't think is good. And she's like a brilliant police officer. Like, absolutely everything, she just like figures it. Well, I figured this happened and then that happened and it must have been one of these here. And just
And probably up there, like, you know, crimes like that don't occur. So
right.
Piece all that together is even more amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think they use that accent in a way to kind of disarm you about how characters are and versus how you think they're going to be. One other thing with that accent I have to comment on. When I was in the Army, I had a first sergeant who was from Minnesota, and he was also like a former drill sergeant. So he did this. He was like the meanest person alive, but you like couldn't tell. He'd always, oh, hey there, Hoffman, how's it going? And then you say, oh, first sergeant's going, oh, that's nice. He just interrupts you and walks away like, that is so demeaning. I don't even, what the hell? But I thought everybody was fantastic. I think, I do think that William H. Macy kind of played a version of that character quite a bit in the 90s. Jerry Lundegaard is the same character he is in Jurassic Park 3 and, you know, two or three other movies, just changed the accent a little bit. So he's kind of broken out of that mold. John Carroll Lynch is one of my very, very favorite character actors. Although I still always think of him as Drew Carey's older brother from the Drew Carey Show. but he's awesome. You think of him as Norm, but he's also, you know, maybe the Zodiac Killer. You know what I mean? He's one of those actors that his range is just all over the place. Everybody was great. Steve Buscemi did what he does best. Peter Stormare is the guy who says the Russian guy and everything, because he's literally the Russian guy and everything.
This is how we do things in Russian space station.
Yeah. But he is so good in this. I mean, he's haunting in this, man.
Here's what I like about him in this movie is that he plays it in such a way that you're almost sympathetic towards him. You got, like,
towards who?
Towards Peter Stormare. He is a bad dude. But the dude just wants to just be in the moment. And he's got a lot of different things that are coming at him, and he just wants peace and quiet. He just wants to sit, watch his TV, and just be done with it. But when things don't go his way, that's when you see the violent tendencies come out, you know?
Ooh, you and I have different feelings on this character. I love it.
It's just a takeaway that I took.
You're allowed to think your own opinions. I'm not here to fight you.
This guy just wants to watch TV, and if you're not quiet, he's going to shoot you in the head. How do you feel bad for this guy?
He is a psychopath, and the fact that he can kill and drop somebody the drop of a hat and then throw him in a wood chipper, he is evil. But you know, a part of me is like, damn, you know, he's complex, and because he's complex, you get that feeling like
that's the parent in you just wanting peace and quiet.
It could be. Let's keep talking characters. Aaron, what's your piece on Peter Stormare and everybody else?
I think he's a complete and utter sociopath.
Okay.
I think he has no moral remorse at all. The fact that he can just kill. So here's my takeaway with that, his character. And I think the contrast between Steve Buscemi's Carl and Peter Stormare. I think that Griswold is a total sociopath. He shows no emotion, no remorse, and really no moral leanings in any way, shape, or form during the whole thing. He doesn't want peace and quiet. But he shows nothing. Whereas there's like one little time in the beginning where they're meeting in Fargo, and Steve Buscemi's character is like, you're going to kidnap your own wife? Are you sure about this? Like, this seems kind of ridiculous, bro. And that's the only time where Peter Stromware's character is like, it's fucked up. I use the
there F-word. It is. We dropped one.
Officially done. Yes, he's it.
I'm sorry. Oh, but he's like, even that's the only moment where he's like, you want to think about this? Like, that's pretty messed up. And it was almost like that's messed up even for me. Now, it didn't stop him from killing her later because she made too much noise, or for stuffing his coworker in a wood chipper. So I think I found no, and I am a very sympathetic person. I found no sympathy for him whatsoever. I thought he was a terrifying character because he could just so quickly kill someone with no emotion whatsoever.
And you know,
that was my take.
He is a sociopath, and you get that. Like, when they're in the car and the cop pulls him over, and the fact that he just leans, grabs him, opens the glove part, and pulls his gun out. Like, he is a psychopath. But, like,
yeah,
a part of you, just in this viewing, I don't know if it's just this viewing where I looked at it that lens. I don't know. But you're right. He is a bad dude.
Well, I think so much of the dramatic tension in the movie comes from the fact you see Carl compound his idiocy into getting murdered by this man, and you know that the climax is probably going to wind up with Marge encountering this guy, and what's going to happen to her and her and a future newborn baby when she confronts this maniac who is probably a lot more competent killer than she is, and she happens to luck out because he's busy, you know, disposing of his evidence and doesn't have his weapon on hand.
You invited him?
right. And so he takes off in the lake, which is a terrible decision. He probably doesn't know she is 7 months pregnant, and she probably just run around the other end of the house and get in the car before she can turn around and go the other way. But but there was so much tension in that. It's like, what's going to happen when she turns around that corner? Is this the end of our hero? And fortunately, her luck prevails and she wins out. But I love that tension with that character, because I think the whole silent killer sociopath motif that is so well embodied by this actor is just leading up to this final climax. And fortunately, it goes our hero's way.
Yeah. And what's great is they're like moral opposites, right? They each kind of represent the moral opposition. Him is the evil. Her is the good, and you know, the Coens are, it's interesting that they're able to show good, evil, and gray. right? I think they give such a great scope of morality in their movies. And you believe that the good are all good. You believe the evil are all evil. And then a lot, most of the characters fall in that gray territory. And they do such a great job. And those two were the opposite poles that met at the end. So that was a great observation.
Ryan, why don't you go ahead and keep going on your thoughts when it comes to, you know, the acting?
Well, yeah, I mean, something Jay said there with the chaotic evil and the chaotic neutral and all the shades of morality in between, you also get that from a perspective of gender roles in this movie, which I think was way ahead of its time for movies at that period, right? Not just the fact that we had a badass heroine leading a police department, but also just their exploration of masculinity and all the shades of it that we see in this movie, from probably the ideal, comfortable in his own shoes masculinity of Norm, her husband, who is not going to let her leave for that triple homicide until she gets her eggs, right? And then you have the pathetic wannabe, the manly man, Jerry, who is clearly failing at it and knows he's failing at it in his heart the entire movie, but just wants to be like his father-in-law and have that type of power. And then you have your traditional capitalist male has it all with the family in Wade and his friendly sidekick Stan. We're not a bank Jerry Grossman. and then you have all of the just, we're going through our life. We're not really going to be great at our job, but we don't really have to in the police department surrounding Marge Gunderson. And of course, and I hope we talk a little bit more about this, the classic scene with Mike Yamagita, right? And
I was gonna bring it up.
Going on there, right? But I just think that this film's explorations of gender role and specifically masculinity is just fascinating to talk about, and something that still is just as much interesting to talk about today in this era as it was back then.
Awesome. Thank you. Brandon, what about you? What are your thoughts when it comes to the acting of this film?
Well, no, I echo, you know, what everybody said, but I got to say that to me, the biggest strength of this movie is nobody even seems like they're acting. It seems almost documentary and how they're acting. There's such a improvisational quality to everybody, and everything just seems to be happening on the spot. And I read this, and I forget where exactly I read it, but somebody said, a critic somewhere, it's a movie that was made in America, it's an American film, and yet it feels like a foreign film at times, because you feel like you are in a totally different world than the world that we live in a lot of the times, because they make this area of the country seem so distant from what we live a lot of the times. And maybe it's because of the way the landscape looks, or maybe it's because of the exaggerated speech. But yeah, I think Frances McDormand, I think Marge Gunderson's one of the great movie characters of all time. I think that, you know, she's the alpha hero, and yet she's this meek and mild, you know, character that seems like a Sunday school teacher when she talks. And yet, you know, she can take down this, you know, brutal assassin with, you know, just a couple of shots. But I don't know, this time around, I was like, you know, you have all these alpha people on both sides, good and evil. And the one that always irks me that I just want to see get his comeuppance is Jerry. I'm like, it's the Weasley character I can't stand at the end of the movie. And we'll get into it probably when we talk about the TV show, but I feel the same way at the end of season one. But give me these alpha characters, you know, but it's this little guy in the middle who just, you know, is such a coward and is trying to crawl through a window in his underwear at the end. I'm like, just die already. But
I mean, like, everyone's running around, and I think it's very easy to be like, I mean, obviously, Carl and the Russian, even though that's not his name, but like, they're outwardly committing these very awful crimes. And obviously, Jerry didn't even, again, he didn't even have the courage to do himself. He outsources it to someone else. But the thing that was actually most bothersome to me was that when he left, when he ran away and fled Margie, I'm like, he left his kid. He was in a hotel. He left his child who had just lost his mother.
And his grandfather.
Yeah.
There was that great scene when Stan Grossman reminds him that he has a son.
Yeah.
And this look on Macy's face, on Jerry's face, just priceless because he realizes, oh, yeah, I am kind of ruining my family's life. But then he snaps back to his mission, which is to be the pathetic criminal that he is.
So, I mean, just some of the things that I want to touch on. William H. Macy, he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. Best Supporting Actor, and he felt like such a lead. I mean, Woman got nominated for Best, and she won for Best Actress, and she wasn't even introduced until the first half hour was over. So she's really only in the film for like an hour, even if that.
I totally forgot that too, that she was not, like when I rewatched, I was like, oh my God, she's like not in the beginning. It's
not in the beginning at all.
At all.
You know, and that's what I think works for the movie is that you enter a world that is just inherently evil and so much scheming. And then you have a beacon in the middle that brings hope and you know, what a hero should be. Because she is just inherently good, you know, and she's just genuine, you know. Well, think I'm going to barf. It's gone. So, I mean, like, she's just being herself, and that's just what's so great in the facade of masculinity, as Ryan Hunt said, because every male character is just up to no good, whereas they're completely dumb, and she is just on the ball. But William H. Macy, you know, the fact that he was supporting actor, but I mean, just his mannerisms, like, and when he's talking on the phone about the VIN numbers, you can just see that I get off the phone, get off. Like, his expressions are so exuberant in this film. One of the most classic shots in this film is that scene of him driving by the ticket taker at the parking lot, and he's dead, and you just see it's that drive by look, staring at. It's one of the most iconic scenes. You see that play all the time when they're talking about Fargo, and just that expression. It's like, to me, when you see that shot, that is him and his expression saying, "I'm at the point of no return." Like it's just brilliantly done. No words. Beautifully written by the Coen brothers. Beautifully acted. And I agree with William H. Macy. They would screw up the movie if he was not in it. So, what? Somebody got something to say?
I was going to say, fun fact about that whole issue with the GMAC loans, that part of the movie, because, you know, when they say in the beginning, it's based on a true story, and that's kind of like a play on movies that say they're based on a true story but aren't. I guess the Coen brothers did that kind of in jest. But the whole GMAC Ponzi scheme-ish kind of thing was a real thing that happened in real life through the General Motors financing arms, that someone, like a network of criminals, literally fraudulently took out like $6 billion in these loans. And they all got caught, but it was like 67 different corporations. They were saying that they were sending vans through a car dealership to Cyprus and then using it this way to get those loans. So I thought that was an interesting little caveat.
Yeah, for sure. One other thing, oh man, I just lost it, is with Marge Gunderson, you know, what I love about her portrayal is you see her doing what she needs to do, but then when it comes to something that she's not necessarily sure about, she's very trepidatious. And I'm talking about when she goes to meet, oh, somebody help me out. What's his name?
Mike Yamagita.
Yeah, Mike Yamagita. You can see the trepidation, but then you see her stand her ground. And I was like, yes, do it. You know, when he comes to sit by her, she's like, you need to go back over there. I'm like, yes. So, like, it was very well done. And, of course, I'm going to segue into the next thing. I just think everything about this production, from the production design, all our locations, you know, the screenplay was fantastic. It won, of course. And then, of course, Roger Deakins. How could I forget Roger Deakins? You know, just some of the shots that he gave us in this film, from completely all white to complete darkness to a very well-lit parking lot. I mean, everything about it was just fantastic. But, yeah, that's going to be my two cents when it comes to takeaways. Anybody else want to jump in and say things that they liked?
Yeah, I want to riff off, we've mentioned some of them already, so we've shortened it up, but just the layer upon layer upon layer of different themes that are littered throughout this. The good versus evil, and that one's, you know, one of the more kind of obvious ones. Ryan mentioned the the power gender dynamics and how those were different than a lot of movies at the time and even now. And me and host Ryan, we'll get into women's empowerment in a little bit, Aaron, just to keep you abreast of how that works. You know,
I never know how to be a woman unless Jay and Ryan are telling me.
That's what we're here for. That's what we're here for.
Thanks, guys. You betcha. Thanks.
And not just that, just kind of fluid power dynamics. Just that end scene that you mentioned where it all culminates and we see it. It wasn't just that, good versus evil, man versus woman. You also saw the power shift, you know, take all that away, the power shift. That was the first time in the movie that that character was scared.
He was scared
of this very pregnant, tiny, you know, when he's this big guy. That's why my name on here is Big Fella. Oh, he's a big fella. You know, he's a big guy and very intimidating in all his scenes. And he turns into a coward. So there's those power dynamics. One of the themes that's kind of my favorite, though, is the competent versus incompetent. And that seems like a thing that's in all Coen Brothers movies. And it's not something you'd think of as a theme, but I do, right? I appreciate that mix, right? The people we think are going to be most competent tend not to be in their movies, and this one holds true to that. And then the ones we think probably aren't going to be competent tend to be highly competent. And it's just, I think it creates an interesting dynamic, just like the one doofus police officer that was with her when they respond to the initial accident. You know, he's searching for plates, you know, DLR, and she just kind of calls him out in a hilarious way, too. And, you know, probably dealer plates there, buddy. I think you got it. I think you got it wrong. You know, I love that dynamic. And I think it's just a thing as I get older, I appreciate to no end, like, people that are competent and take pride in things. And they show that in their movies. And then, like all those other people, like, right, it starts to fray on your nerves. It's annoying how incompetent they are and the problems that it causes. So I like that kind of theme that they always slide in there. You know, like, guess what I learned the other day? I've been wearing the wrong size shoes for most of my adult life. How'd I find that out? An incredibly competent shoe salesman who was like, yeah, here's what happens. There's gravity on Earth. Your foot gets flatter, gets fatter and longer the longer you're alive on Earth. So you're blah, blah, blah. I mean, he's going on and on. You know, this is COVID days. You're not supposed to shake hands. I literally shook his hand and said, I appreciate the pride and competence you have in your job. Because I'm like, I didn't know shoes were supposed to feel like this. So that's one of the other themes that I really, really like. And you could go on for days with those. But that's my takeaway.
For sure. I mean, let's talk to Mr. Hunt. Mr. Hunt, I asked you on this podcast – because when you were a freshman, you wrote a paper about greed and the American life. And I think that is wrapped up perfectly in that final scene where she is hauling off the big guy, the big fella. And she just goes, I just don't understand it. So that's perfectly encapsulating. You've got these people trying to get rich quick, and she just can't wrap her head around it. So, Ryan, I want you to deep dive. Go, I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot. You can talk about whatever you want, but I mean, I really enjoy your paper.
We're putting you on the spot.
We are, of course. That's talk about everything, this, right? No, I mean, that is a central theme. It's on its face, and so many of the Coen Brothers movies explore this theme very, very well through all different shades of characters and plot devices. But for Marge, you know, the 3 cent stamp is just as important as the 29 cent stamp is just as important as the $1 million that Jerry and Carl are chasing, right? But that's not what drives the other characters in this film. And just the juxtaposition between our avatar of heroism versus all the men she's encountering around her is portrayed. And I don't think it's too deep of a theme here, but it's so well portrayed and poetically and tragically portrayed by seeing all of these men chase money and compound their problems by going one step further when they could have just bailed or gotten out, right? So when Carl hilariously could have walked away with $920,000 but insists that he gets that $15,000 car and then dies because of it, right? It's just one of many examples in this movie of how when we are driven by that next dollar, that last dollar, that next business deal, what can happen to us when that's all that motivates us. In the case of Jerry, though, I think it's a little more complex than that. Yeah, he's clearly indebted himself a lot, and he's in big trouble, and he needs to dig himself out of that hole. But I think the first act of the movie does a great job of showing very subtly why he breaks bad, so to speak, right? And he's not happy with his life. He's not happy with how people see him. When that man dresses him down in the auto dealership for being a liar, right, that cuts to the core of his manhood. He wants to be tougher. He wants to be not bothered by something like that. He wants to march into his father-in-law's office and be seen as an equal in that boardroom. So I think his greed is more of chasing a better version of himself in his stature as a man, but that comes with money. You have to have the money to have that power and that comfort. But for Norm, man, it's just that 29-cent stamp is all he needs. But the 3-cent stamp is just as good, according to Marge. And I think the choice of ending the movie on that scene and that moment is very fitting and speaks to this theme of greed and how, you know, if you set that aside and focus on the more important things in life, family and relationship, that's where you should put your focus.
Is there anything else, Ryan, that you would like to talk about when it comes to takeaways or?
No, I mean, I echo everyone else's sentiments here. I'm just curious. We mentioned the great Roger Deakins like 15 times on the show. Any lightning round brilliant shots in this movie that stick out to you? My favorite one was that two-dimensional overhead shot of Walt trudging back to his car in the snow after his failed deal with Wade. But any other shots that stick out to you guys?
Like I said, it was when he gets out of the car to go gun down the people that pass by and just, you know, he emerges and goes into that light. So he's absorbing the light and bring more darkness. I mean, that's just a very powerful image of a sociopath. So does anybody else have another favorite shot that they want to give a shout out to?
No? I just like it's something simple. Just the when they're driving and there's like the heavy snowstorms hitting in, you know, yeah. It really hits home that like these people sound super nice because they are super nice because they're super hardy. Like, this is a mm-hmm. tough part of the world to live in. Like, to live in all that. Oh, my. I would go nuts with all that snow. And just all the crap you'd have to deal with that would come up with that lifestyle. Like, they're a hardy people, you know, that live that lifestyle. So, yeah, they're courteous just because they know, like, you know, I got to shovel the drive every single day just to go anywhere. So I like those shots because I think it hammers at home kind of to your subconscious, like, hey, this is tough living. These are tough people.
One of the most tension-filled scenes, I think, is when they are pulled over, is the fact that Deacon.
Uh-oh, like you're freezing up a little bit, Ryan.
Your excitement over Roger Deakins is freezing your computer.
It happens.
It's too much energy to harness.
You're sweating all over your keyboard, I think.
I am. Am I good right now, though? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, you're good.
Okay. No, just real quick, it's just, you know, because that it's so bright, you're seeing everything and what's going to happen. So anything else? Brandon, what are your thoughts overall?
What I always enjoy when I watch this is that it always shows that life is messy and that nothing that you plan ever goes the way that you really intended to happen. I mean, you know, the initial kidnapping doesn't go as planned. It's a lot messier than what they thought would happen. Getting pulled over, you know, you know, and then they get rid of the cop, and then, you know, a car comes by, and then it gets messy again. You know, and then he goes to collect the money, and then Wade comes and shoots him in the cheek. You know, so many things happen, you know, and things awkwardly happen, and, you know, nothing, you know, and most movies like this, you know, a kidnapping scheme would go off without a hitch. No one would see you or anything, but this shows you how life works and how, you know, even the best laid plans are never going to go your way. And, that's something else that I think the Coen brothers really bring to it as well. And along with the cinematography, yeah, just the bleakness and the white of the snow and everything, and how it's easy to spot a blemish in that kind of world. And so when something erroneous happens, like a murder, it's easy for Marge to know that something's going on. So in this sort of perfect white winter world, you know, when there's a little blood stain on it, you're going to spot it pretty easily.
Yeah, that's interesting you say, like, it shows life. Like, the Coen brothers are so good. They put the weirdest, like, real-life things in their movie. Like, Margie goes to get in her car, and she walks back in. I need you to come. I need a jump. Got to get a jump on the car. Why? Like, it's like 10 seconds. Like, yeah. they just throw those little things in there, and they're kind of funny and kind of quirky, and they're just, like, so real.
And the conversation at the dinner table when Wade's complaining about the son going to McDonald's after dinner, that's something any grandparent would complain about or something. So,
yeah.
Like I said, they capture humans. Like, they just capture the human spirit. Mm-hmm. Brandon, thank you for that. Aaron, what are your takeaways when it comes to Fargo?
So good. Remember working, so before I'm a nurse, and before I had the job I was in now, I was the coordinator and like director of our heart lung bypass machine program at the hospital I work at. So that was like, I was in charge of staffing, coordination, logistics of like people who were deathly ill requiring ECMO, which is heart lung bypass. And it's a very physically taxing, mentally, emotionally taxing job. And I was very, very pregnant working that job. And like, like I just relate to Margie so much. Where like, I remember trudging through the units at like 3 a.m. on 4th of July because we were putting a baby on in the middle of the night. And that people just being like, hey, Aaron, like, you know, and I'm like 8 months pregnant, like, hey, guys. Pushing a circuit that like could come out, and like if anything goes wrong, like that is the end of someone's life. It's the fastest way to die in a hospital, you know? So just like these very stressful situations where you're just trudging along, you're doing a job you love, and you're just doing it. And some people are really incompetent along the way, and some people are not, but you got to do your job to the best of the ability, no matter the circumstances. If you're doing something and you have, I think, a moral code. I think what Margie and Norm also have, she kind of gives it, and it's a very simple one, at the end of the movie when she's talking to, what's his name, in the back of the squad car. She's just, it's a very simple speech, but it packs a lot of punch, where it was just like, was this all worth it? Was this money worth it? Because she has a code. They have a code in which they live by. And I think it's easy. I don't want to say it's easy, like, to always point the finger and blame money. But at the end of the day, money in and of itself is amoral. It's what an individual does with that money or for that money that poses the problem. The money doesn't have ethics. The money doesn't have morals. It's the people dealing with it. And, you know, they all made choices that were terrible in order to achieve this thing or for other things, you know, other ways. But she just, I loved seeing, I think this is probably intentional as most things with the Coen brothers are, but the juxtaposition between lifestyles in the 80s too. You've got every time you're seeing Jerry's family, you know, it's a suburban house in Minneapolis, like all very like the Honey Oak, like it's a very up-to-date house for the 80s. I have Honey Oak cabinets in my kitchen and I hate them, but they were super awesome in 1987. But like that was like top of the line, right? So is he keeping up or trying to achieve a lifestyle on top of requiring all this external validation. And then you've got Margie and her husband and like everything about their just way of life, like where they live, their kitchen, everything. It's just more moderate.
Simple.
It's more simple. And like you said, Jay, not, you know, when you're like, they're just like more simple. And I know you don't mean that in like a negative way, but just like there are certain maybe things that they were just not into. And I think those are issues and things that can be applied today in the sense of I think it's a matter of conscious choosing of what kind of not only your own moral code, your own convictions, but like what you're going to choose to give energy to or attention to or validation to. And what you're not going to. And I think that's in terms of money, lifestyle, external validation, like in the world of social media and everything right now, it's very easy to get wrapped up in your social, in your like validation being outsourced. So I just think that this is kind of a movie, even though it's 25 years old and it takes place, you know, in a seemingly distant past, there are just themes in this movie that are going to be timeless and are lessons to be learned. And to Ryan Hunt's point, that it's more of a literature now in motion to watch this and to have takeaways from.
Yeah. So, I mean, anybody else got any takeaways before I ask the question about improvements? Okay. So, improvements. Does the movie this damn near perfect? Because it is damn near perfect. Is there any room for improvement on this movie? I'm just going to open it up. Does anybody think of anything? I will share at the very end, I did have a conversation with someone who thought of a flaw, and I kind of turned them around back to being like, oh, it's not a flaw. But does anybody have an improvement that they would like to talk about? Is this movie perfect?
Like I said, I would just tamp down the accent a touch. Just a touch, because I think they do use it to great effect. And I'll tell you why I feel that way is the next thing we move into is the shows. It's tamped down and it's still effective in the same way. But it goes along with the Coen Brothers style of quirk. But that'd be the only kind of – just like if I'm digging a very deep hole to find anything to say anything problem. About, that's it. Yeah.
Does anybody have anything else?
Yeah, I agree with that. And to your point, Ryan, like you can poke holes in this movie and then talk yourself out of them really fast. So on a recent rewatch, I was like, I didn't buy that Wade would buy Jerry's story about the kidnapping quite as fast as he did. He's a terrible liar. Like, how could you see this guy as being earnest in any way, shape, or form? And it's clear Wade doesn't like the guy to begin with. But
yeah.
The more I thought about it, it was clear that his partner Stan turned him around on it, and he saw himself as the potential hero to save his daughter's wife from her hapless husband who got her into this mess and took it upon himself to deliver the money and save his daughter, right? So I talked myself out of that critique as fast as I rendered it, because it is a very strong movie front to back. And
I like what you said there. Because Wade, you see him, he's very calculating by the books, you know. When they want that land deal, he's like, send it over, you know, send it over. Let me look it over. Like, he's very calm, cool, and precise. But, you know, there is that factor of that gut wrench, oh, my daughter's kidnapped, I got to do something. So, I mean, I see where
And Ryan, either Ryan's, do you guys think that Wade clearly didn't think much of Jerry, but... with the whole, I guess, kind of theme of like up there, you know, people were a little more trusting, bad things don't happen very often, maybe, so people aren't as jaded or as, you know, like aren't as cynical. So like, did he trust Jerry more because his partner was a little bit more like, not naive, but like, yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right, Jerry. We do need to follow this. And like, that's why he kind of trusted him a little more. What do you think?
Yeah. I buy that reading, and I also like weaving that in with Jay's theme of the shades of incompetence. So we're immediately established. We've immediately established Wade as a successful businessman who's got everything together and has it all figured out. But in this one area, his own hubris and ego got in the way of being a rational person. So that was his example of incompetence that ultimately led to his.
And you could even say the flip side, like, he knows his son-in-law is an incompetent buffoon, so this is just his incompetent buffoon way of trying to handle this situation.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
There's so many different ways you can look at it.
Good point.
The other scene that I see talked about as being like, why is this in the movie? This is kind of just a weird distraction, but I think it just misses the brilliance of a lot of Coen moments of why do they add things like the car being jumped into their movies, right? And that's the Mike Yamagita scene. Completely out of place, seemingly has nothing to do with the plot, but it's actually the major driver of Margie's willingness to go right back into the auto lot and interrogate Jerry again because Mike lied to her. She finds out from her high school friend that she was lied to, and suddenly she becomes a lot less trusting and needs to solve this case by going after the prime suspect, and she does, right? So a scene like that is sometimes criticized as being like, yeah, that was just, you know, a waste of a few minutes, is not at all. It's actually core to the film, and one of the scenes in the movie I look forward to watching the most because of that.
That's a good point. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and you pick up on it because, you know, you think that she's just there to reconnect, and then it reinforces her stance as a strong woman. Aaron, there you go. As a strong woman, you know, she's not going to take any BS from, you know, anybody.
Or just a good police officer.
Or just a good police officer. But then when she calls her friend about the wife, she's like, oh, yeah, they were, you know, all this, you know, everything unfolded her. She's like, okay, I need to reassess some things. So like Mr. Hunt was saying, she goes back, and that's what causes him to get out of town. So anybody else got any improvements before I share my story? Okay, so I had somebody tell me that they wanted to know more about William H.'s backstory. Why is he in the financial position that he is in? Why does he need to do this, you know, this fake kidnap or this kidnap? It's not fake. And I said, you don't need to know that. You look at his character as it progresses in the movie, and you see that he is not a very thought out person. He just goes from the gut. And so if he's just making purchases, I mean, it could be as simple as that. And he's in the hole, you know, he could be a better, that's what leads the Coen brothers to be such good writers is you don't need to know the backstory because they're going to show that through his characterization and how much of a bad person he is in terms of just planning, you know, And that leads to you understanding, okay, he's just a terrible, you know, financial person, and that's what's causing him to hatch this plan. And they go, okay, I'm going to rewatch it. They rewatch him like, you're totally right. You don't need to know his backstory because it's just a means to an end because you get that characterization as you know. This movie is damn near perfect, so it's very hard to rip it apart. And because it's so damn near perfect, we're going to move into our next topic of conversation. This is where I take a seat back. This movie has spawned a TV show. It has gone 4 seasons now, with the 4th season just finishing up on FX with Chris Rock. Apparently the 4th season is one of the best, but we can't count out the other 3 seasons because they're almost just as good. Jay, Brandon, and Ryan have viewed the show, all 4 seasons. So let's get your guys – just the first 2. I've seen the first 1. Let's get your guys' take, and if you want to rank them or say which is better – that's fine. So let's start with Ryan. Ryan Hunt.
Yeah, I mean, well, Noah Hawley is clearly a student of the Coen brothers and loves everything about the original film. So I was very nervous about this going in. It's like, okay, how do you mess with perfection and take that over 10 episodes and still get juice out of it, let alone carry it on for 3 more seasons within this world? And you know what? They did it. And they honored, especially in the first season, the original themes of the movie and many of the beats. But they threw their excellent spin on it by just some brilliant casting choices throughout the roster, right? Instead of the flailing crazy evil, chaotic evil of Carl, you have almost the devil incarnate version of him pulling all the strings in Billy Bob Thornton. And if you haven't seen this series, he is worth the price of admission for season one, as well as all the fantastic turns by Martin Freeman and guest spots, I can't believe all the names. Bob Odenkirk. And yeah, you can just
this
go
show
down
the has bigger stars than the movie did.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's tons in a season.
Absolutely. And then, so how do they keep that going? And they create a little universe or a world in that plain state, upper Midwest crime syndicate thing they have going throughout. But it works. And then in season two, you still get the in over their head themes via the just absolutely brilliant characters portrayed by Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons. Two of my favorite characters in recent TV history portrayed by them. So, yeah, highly recommend going back through and watch this. Even if you haven't seen the original film or are a huge fan of it, I think this show carries its own weight by a mile.
All right, Brandon, what are your two thoughts? I just saw the first two seasons. I just did one, so I'm going to take it.
Season one, to me, perfectly captures what was great about the movie, and it even expands on that. It's sort of the movie on steroids because you get longer over 10 episodes, you get longer time to explore characters, you know. But I think Martin Freeman's character in season one is, you know, William H. Macy's character, but just even more Weasley, in my opinion.
Much slimier.
But yeah, you're right, Ryan. Billy Bob Thornton is worth the price of admission alone. Terrifying. I had to sleep with one eye open after I finished season one. but I have to say, I think season two tops season one even. I think they create this mythos in season one, and then it pays off in season two when you realize all the different connections. And it's a group of some of my favorite actors. You get Ted Danson and Gene Smart and Patrick Wilson, all of these great, great actors in season two. And it really plays on American history. It plays on so many great things in that season. And so, Ryan Holly did a miracle. I mean, he took a perfect movie and created a pretty perfect TV show.
Awesome. Jay, what are your thoughts when it comes to the TV show?
Well, as you guys know, I've been pushing everybody to watch this show because I love it so much. This is a show that I did not want to watch. I was like, why would you make a show based off of I cannot think of a movie that I would less think, what needs an expanded, you know, universe for us to watch than Fargo?
The English Patient.
Yeah. Well, the expanded universe would probably be far more interesting than what it's based on.
I was playing the home game. That's what Fargo lost the best actor or best pitcher to.
Yeah.
That's right.
But, yeah, like I said, Noah Hawley, clear. And it's not just Fargo, right? Fargo is the basis for the show. It's an anthology show, though. Right, each season they're loosely connected. Each season is a totally different season, different era, different storyline with just little connectors throughout. And Noah Hawley just announced that he is going to be doing an Alien TV show. So I probably wouldn't have thought much of it until I watched the show. Now I'm super excited for that.
Yeah, sign me up for that. That's great.
But Fargo is the basis for the show, but it's really a Coen Brothers movie, like pulling everything in. And that the Coen Brothers are producers on it. And Noah Hawley's even said, you know, I pull from this movie and this movie and this movie of theirs. So it's really the Coen Brothers expanded universe TV show is what it is. And if I were to rank all these, right, because I would do each season. This might go against other people's beliefs, but I would put season two, then the movie. That's how much I liked season two. I actually think season two is one of the greatest seasons of television ever. Patrick Wilson in that, and you know, Brandon and I were texting. He's like, I love this person. This, like, every character we were going, but Patrick Wilson. is the very definition of competent, and he's always going on those actors. I'm like, he's a good actor. I want him to be in my imaginary army against zombies someday. I want that guy. I want that character that he played. I love it so much. So if I were to rank, I'd go season 2, then I would go the movie, then I would go season 4, season 1, and season 3. And I don't want to give anything about seasons away because that's not what we're here to talk about, but the show is impressive.
So let's just rank them. So, Brandon, you've got 1, 2 in the movie. How would you rank them?
Movie, season 2, season 1.
Okay, so I've only seen the first season, so I'm going to say movie season 1. Mr. Hunt, what's your definitive ranking when it comes to the seasons?
Yeah, probably movie season 2, season 1, season 3, and I haven't started on 4 yet. But 2 and 2 in the movie are really close. Because 2 is nothing like the movie thematically. There are some connections there, but I like Jay's framing of it as pulling from all of the Coen brothers' repertoire to create just a masterclass of television. Those two are very close for me. And even season 3, which is probably regarded as the weakest of the 4 seasons, still has a lot to go for, right? Carrie Coons is one of the best actors today, and she is our protagonist in that season. It is worth every minute you get to see her perform.
And that season was so weird.
So weird.
In an already super weird show. Like, it was so weird, but it pays off if you mm-hmm. just got to stick with that.
Exactly. And you get some Nick Offerman, just gems throughout. not enough, in my opinion, but just enough to give it that that great wit.
Well, let's dive into Impact, because this movie has had a huge impact. I mean, it spawned an anthology TV show where crime is the foreground, because this movie is almost the perfect crime, but imperfect crime. So let's just talk Impact. We're going to let the guests go first. Brandon, we'll start with you, and then we'll throw it to Ryan. What do you think the impact of Fargo is 25 years later?
I think the impact is still kind of like I said in the beginning. You know, it sort of made independent films more mainstream. We have more access to them now because I think audiences started to embrace that good movies don't necessarily have to be made by big studios. Don't necessarily have to have multi-million dollar budgets. But I think that I think it sort of paved the way for more irreverent kind of crime movies. You know, crime films that can have comedy in them. I mean, that we'd seen stuff before, but this is much more on a more prestigious scale, I guess you could say. And like you mentioned before, you know, just 2 years after it came out, it was, you know, on the top 100 list. And then 10 years later when they re-voted, it wasn't there. But they had a whole other decade of movies that kind of replaced it. You know, Saving Private Ryan's on there now, and Titanic and other movies that came along and sort of unseated it. But, you know, maybe if they voted again in 10 years, it would be back on. You know, opinions change. But I think it's still fresh. And what got me this time again is there's no fat to the movie. It's only 97 minutes. And like you said before, it starts off with the plot right away. It gets going. And it just shows you also that a good movie doesn't have to be 2.5 hours either. So
bring back those 90-minute movies.
Yeah. So I think a lot of modern filmmakers we have now grew up with Fargo and are taking pointers from it.
Thank you, Brandon. Ryan, what do you think about the impact of Fargo?
Well, yeah, I mean, besides, as I said earlier, causing a national fear in wood chippers, I think the main cultural impact, and this is probably not the impact that you would want to have from this, is what Jay mentioned in the Minnesota Nice phenomena. Most people, casual film viewers, see this as, oh, that's the accent movie, the funny accent movie. But I agree with Brandon's take in a lot of regards here. It's showing how you can do a dark comedy correctly, concisely, and make the drama and the comedy equally meaningful and impactful, right? And I just wish more movies were able to capture that. But I think that's going to be its lasting impact for me in the long run. And then, as I said, also just the themes that are enduring and timeless will always stay with this movie, right? From the gender roles to the themes around greed and capitalism work so well, and what embodies it as a classic.
Awesome. Thank you, Ryan. Aaron, your three-day impact statement.
Oh, what an impactful 3 days. I'll probably get to the show in like 12 years. I'll let you know what I got, what I think, guys. It's a great movie. Again, I piggyback off what Ryan said. Like, these are just timeless themes. You can't go wrong, no matter if it's capitalism or whatever kind of economy, money in the wrong hands or of people that don't have the right value system and the right moral compass. Is always going to end up poorly. And so I think that for me, what's been a big impact in that kind of was it, it came before me seeing Fargo was seeing some of the impacts in other types of media of Fargo. So like for me specifically, I am a big Supernatural fan. Most of the people in our podcast group know that. I don't know how much I've talked about another podcast, but huge fan. And one of the characters that comes along in later seasons is Donna Hanscom. And she is a police chief with a very thick Minnesota accent that Supernatural, Eric Kripke, and that show pay homage to Margie. In through her character, not only in the like niceness, but also in how tough she gets. And there's actually a few characters in Supernatural. Like, she's not the only female sheriff. She's not the only strong female lead. So like, I've seen the impact of Fargo in other ways without realizing or understanding fully where it came from. Or what it was, I just understood that it had come from somewhere. That's it. That's my three-day impact.
All right. Jay, what are your thoughts when it comes to the impact of Fargo?
I think it's – I won't say there's an overabundance of them, but I think it's an inspiration for any movie that I'd classify as a neo-Western. I think – directors like Taylor Sheridan, who did Hell or High Water, which was nominated for an Academy Award. He also did He did a movie called Wind River, which is Jeremy Renner's in it. It's amazing, and I tell everybody they should watch it. I've never seen grief portrayed more accurately in film than in that movie. But they're all the neo, you know, kind of Westerns. They're not your traditional cowboys and all that. I think, you know, Dennis Vanilla, I'm going to say his name wrong, Villanueva. I think
that's did Arrival.
Yeah. but he did Sicario. He's got Dune coming out. And I know that, you know, like, look at those movies. You might not think Fargo, but I think they have that kind of neo Western motif to it. So I think you've got a group absolutely of pretty strong current day filmmakers that were, I think you can see the inspiration from this movie on.
Thank you for bringing up Taylor Sheridan, because for all of those who don't know, he is the man behind Yellowstone. He writes every episode. He's very into that show. It is fantastic.
So I didn't even know that. That's a show I told my – I'm like, man, everybody's talking about this freaking show. We should get into it. And now I'm all in.
Every episode.
You know, can I say this, too, about, I guess, Fargo, just how refreshing it is to watch a movie where everyone in the film is not like a – even for the 1990s, is not like a – it's not like a picturesque or a, like – stereotypical like Hollywood star as far as aesthetics go. You know what I'm saying? In the sense of like look, Steve Buscemi was just even not even in the movie is just kind of known as like a funny looking guy, right? Like his teeth aren't perfect now. And it's, I just find that kind of refreshing, you know, that you've got people in roles, like there's not crazy makeup. No one's naked. Well, there's a couple naked women. Let me take that back. But like, there's not like, you don't have the like,
they look like real people.
The '90s. They look like real people. There's not a lot of makeup. There's not crazy costumes. And you just get, when you take all that away, like you just get great performances. And I think sometimes in today's world too, it's like a little like, you know, everyone's got veneers and everyone's got Botox and every, you know, even the dudes and like, you know, that kind of thing. It's just nice to be like, oh yeah. Like that's part of, I think, the comfort of being like, you get to consciously choose, like, are you falling into like what society says you should look like or you should aspire to? And that's okay too, as long as it's a conscious choice and you're not outsourcing your power and your worth to those things. And then you see a movie like this and you're just like, yeah, dude, this is awesome. And everyone's just happy. And
yeah,
the people who live there, like, I don't know. I just, yeah. I found that I appreciated that and I wanted to bring it up.
I think I read one of the Coen brothers said, one of the studio heads at the time said, this movie's never going to sell because you don't have any attractive people in it. Yeah. So, yeah.
So,
it adds to that documentary aesthetic that I think someone else brought up earlier, right? Like when they say this is a real story, I think the way they cast it and portrayed it adds to that aesthetic in a really convincing way. So I found it refreshing and convincing and aiding the narrative as well.
Great point.
This brings up my impact. This movie makes the Coen brothers a Hollywood name. And without them, we would be very unfortunate with these great directors and writers who know how to write the American people. I should just say, they just know how to write people. Because this movie came out in 1996. Before that, they had Barton Fink. They had Miller's Crossing. Very not well known unless you start to dive into their filmography. But this is what really makes them a household name when it comes to cinema, because this movie just came out of nowhere. It was a black comedy. No one didn't even like a black, like murder is funny, but it is because it's just the way it was written. And, you know, since then they've been nominated for so many different Oscars. No Country for Old Men just swept. I mean, they redid True Grit and they did it. So Brandon, you're a classics host. They redid True Grit and some almost say that that's the better film. You know,
it is.
That's another one. It's only like 98 minutes.
Right.
They're pretty terse. It's kind of nice.
They are
closer. It's closer to the novel.
Right. You know, John Wayne's good just because it's got John Wayne in it. Yeah. But I mean, they told a fabulous story and they got more Oscar nominations than what the original did. So, you know, I'm very thankful that we have Fargo because it showed the talent of these two brothers. You know, and they would continue to write, you know, these very timeless stories, because Fargo is timeless, because like we've been talking with the themes, these themes apply now. And this is a movie that you can watch and like, that could happen tomorrow. Because there are people who think that they can get away with murder and they're just as bumbling as our characters in this film. So does anybody else have anything else? Or we wrap it up?
This is the last line, because I love Margie so much. This is the last thing, too, is I think, and I hear you laughing. I hear it. no, but I love while she's having the talk to Grimsrud in the car, where she's like, it's a beautiful day outside. Like, that movie, everything's covered in snow. It's cloudy the whole time. There's no sun. Like, there are so many people outside of that area where you're like, that's not what you would be considered beautiful, right? But she's chosen that it's the perspective. And I just thought that was super powerful, too. And that's another thing, an impact and theme that, like, is, again, timeless. It's like you get to choose your perspective. Like, it might be beautiful to you to live in a place and to have a simple life and to not let your, you know, like, it's not contingent upon so many external things for her to be happy.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, again, just the writing of this film. I mean, it won Best Original Screenplay, and there's a reason for it, so... that's going to do it for us here. Thank you for joining us while we talk about Fargo. To my friend Ryan Hunt, thank you so much. for joining us this evening. It was a pleasure having you.
It was a pleasure being here. And just one thing, shout out to Carl Burwell, the guy who did this amazing score that we didn't talk about once. That's all I'll say.
Violin! Damn! See, that's just... We could sit here and spend 2 hours, you know, and we tend, with the three of us, we do like to take long shows, but when you sit here and you talk about a movie that is just so perfect, you tend to slip up. But the soundtrack is phenomenal. I mean, it's very simple, and again, simplicity. Just simple tones, and then, like, when situations happen, he brings on the drums, you know? Really great in capturing it, so...
Right. Yeah, I didn't realize Carter Burwell is, like, so married to the Coens. He's done almost every score of every movie that they've done, or at least mainstream movies they've done.
Yeah. All right. Ryan, thank you for bringing that up. Again, thank you for being on. I look forward to having you again. You're really insightful, so thank you very much, man. I appreciate it.
We'd love to come back. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Brandon, tell us what's going on in your neck of the woods.
Oh, well, let's see. We released earlier this month our episode on The Sound of Music. It was our first one of 2021. And then coming up at the end of this month, Eric and Allison and I are going to be talking about a movie that turns 90 this month, City Lights, Charlie Chaplin.
All right.
So it's the first silent movie that we're going to talk about on Classics, so we're excited about that. And then at the beginning of February, Aaron's going to join us, and we're going to talk about Annie Hall. So that'll be fun, too.
Super excited about that. It's always fun to be on Classics. Brandon and Eric are a joy to talk with and to listen to their podcast.
When it comes to movies. Tell him I said that, Brandon.
I will. Oh. I promise.
We're going to be together at Anvil and Ford. We're just going to be so weird. Aaron, tell us what we got coming up.
Since we began 2021, we at Flashbacks have moved to 2 episodes a month. So later in January, we're going to be taking a look at Trainspotting for its 25th anniversary.
Yeah, we're really going dark for the month of January.
I know.
I don't know. Have you? We live in the Midwest in January.
It's pretty dark.
Pretty damn depressing.
Yeah.
So might as well watch movies to put you in the mood.
Right. Yeah. Hey, what are you coming up?
Convince Me host Larry Smith and myself, we have started on Flashback Presents Cobra Kai, where we're breaking down seasons 1 and 2, just an overall overview of those two of the hit Netflix show. But we are going to do every episode of Cobra Kai season 3. We've recorded our breakdown of season 1, and we sort of talk about the show and then mostly just make each other laugh for like an hour. So it's people are going to love it. People are going to love it if we ever post it. Still in editing. It's still in editing. And Larry made a really kick-ass theme song and stuff for us. So it's going to be real fun.
Well, it's still relevant because it's still top 10 on Netflix. And people love that show. They love the nostalgia. I mean, I'm sitting here holding up a Coors Banquet, so
I won't say who drinks light beer, but we do on that show.
Right. So in February, in honor of the majestic, expensive, and easy to forget holiday of Valentine's Day, we are upping the romance factor here on Flashbacks. We are going back to the 30th, and we're going to celebrate the 35th anniversary of Pretty in Pink. So with that, I would just once again like to thank our very special guest, Mr. Ryan Hunt. Thank you very much for joining us. And Mr. Brandon Davis, our fellow Front Row host of Front Row Classics. Thank you both for joining us in our conversation about Fargo.
Thank you for listening to Front Row Flashbacks, and make sure to tell your friends to check us out. Our pod is on any number of podcast apps, so look us up and please subscribe. While you're at it, if you really dig what we do, please join us as a full-time patron. Our Patreon link is in the show notes, and we would love for you to give us your money. I mean, to be a part of the team.
And be sure to look up the Front Row Network for any of our other content, like Front Row Classics, with hosts Brandon Davis and Eric Flick. Hold on a minute. We've got a guy on this podcast with the last name Flick.
He legally changed it for the show because that's the dedication we bring
people at the Front Row Network.
Well, that's amazing, and just as amazing as some of our other shows, such as Guilty Pleasures, hosted by Lou Hare, and our Beyond the Mouse crew that covers all things Disney and so much more.
In short, we have something for everyone at the Front Row Network. Make sure you find the Front Row Network on Facebook and subscribe to our main feed on Spotify or whatever you use to access your podcast. We can also be found on NPR Illinois' website under Community Voices, and you can follow us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z. For the Front Row Flashbacks, this has been Ryan Lutens,
Jay Hoffman,
and Aaron McCabe.
And we will see you all in the front row.